Hello, good morning and welcome to the Biz News Briefing this Tuesday, the 29th of October. Magnus Haystack will be taking us through the latest investment and business news. We've got a couple of inserts from an interview that my colleague Chris Steyn had yesterday with the new Minister of Sport, the third most popular politician in South Africa, Gayton McKenzie. And then we have an anonymous whistleblower who's been looking into all of these deep fraud or deep fake adverts. This time, Hashim Amla is telling people, not really Hashim, but telling people to invest with a company called, well, that has the same chief operating officer as Bankso, which has been suspended by the authorities. What gives? And in the second half of today's show, we're going to dig deep into the fracas at Vilgenhof. It looks like the chair of the Stellenbosch University Council and the vice chancellor might be given the boot after tampering with a report so that their agenda could be followed. That's the allegation anyway. And then Ian Cameron, a good friend of BizNews, he's been at a number of our conferences and will be back again at the next conference in March next year. Ian will tell us about a major breakthrough on South African police services, this for the auditing of those 200 plus generals on how good they really are. Big blow for CADA deployment, that one. But first, as we usually do, let's kick off with the news headlines from our partners at Bloomberg in the United States. Here's what's been going on overnight.
The Biden administration today finalized restrictions on investments by U.S. individuals and companies into advanced technology in China, including semiconductors, quantum computing, and artificial intelligence. Those rules come after more than a year of deliberation. Taiwan says it welcomes applications from international satellite firms to offer services on the island as it looks to strengthen the resilience of its communication systems. The Ministry of Digital Affairs made the comments after the Wall Street Journal reported last Friday that Russian leader Vladimir Putin once asked Elon Musk to withhold his Starlink service over Taiwan as a favor to Chinese President Xi Jinping. Angela Stent, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, says Musk's conversations with Putin raise troubling questions.
Of course, you have Elon Musk's support of former President Trump. He's paying people to register to vote. And of course, you have the reports of former President Trump's conversations with Putin that have happened since he was president. And you just wonder where all this is leading. Musk is a very wealthy man. Putin is reportedly also a very wealthy man. So I don't know if this is part of the club of billionaires, but there should be security concerns here.
Angela Stent, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Wall Street veteran Ed Yardeni says the approaching U.S. election could augur the return of the market's bond vigilantes as the Treasury Department readies new debt issuance plans.
If we get a sweep of either the Democrats or the Republicans, the bond market will conclude that nothing will stop either party from spending a lot, maybe cutting taxes a lot for some folks, not for others, and all in all, continuing to widen the deficit and the debt. Meanwhile, the interest payments continue to accumulate and will probably hit $1 trillion.
The founder of Yardeni Research famously coined the phrase in the 1980s to describe investors selling bonds to set the U.S. government back on a course of fiscal restraint. Third quarter earnings later today from Google's parent company Alphabet. Bloomberg's Tom Busby has more on what investors will be looking for.
Alphabet expected to show strong revenue and profit growth thanks to its cloud computing division and from ads on its Google Internet search business. Investors will also be looking for the latest monetization efforts for Gemini, Alphabet's generative AI program. Bloomberg Consensus calls for revenue of $86.44 billion, most of that from Google search ads. Earnings per share, $1.83, and shares of Alphabet up 19% so far this year. Tom Busby, Bloomberg Radio.
And this is the busiest week for corporate earnings. Five of the Magnificent Seven companies are scheduled to report.
five of the Magnificent Seven. Magnus Haystack is the Magnificent One. Lovely talking with you as always, Magnus. I guess you've been paying attention, or will be paying attention, to what's going on in Wall Street and those results that come out, starting with Alphabet tonight.
Indeed. Good morning, Alec. Nice to talk to you and to your listeners and viewers. You know, of course, you know, I start with what's happening in the American markets. I mean, that's just the driving force of all markets. And, you know, then you look at South Africa. And, you know, it's been a fascinating year for all the major indices in the United States. The NASDAQ at record levels, the S&P 500. And this has spilled over into the South African market. So
Oh, dear. We seem to have lost Magnus for a moment, hopefully temporarily. Are you back, Magnus? I can hear you again.
I can hear you loud and clear.
Okay. You were talking about how important it is now for South African investors on what happens in the U.S. And it's so different, isn't it, to years ago when the two of us were young reporters in newspapers, where we couldn't give a fig about what happened outside of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. Of course, today that's turned on its head.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, you know, we've now, most high net worth South Africans and even average South Africans now do have a large exposure to world markets, which is a good thing. And, you know, we are driven by world events, and the U.S. market, you have to follow that market. You have to follow the European markets, London market. And it's been a fantastic market for equity markets all around the world this year. All the major indices are at record levels. JSE, nice to say, it's having a terrific year, a terrific 6 months with the strengthening of the rand, the GNU, the confidence coming back. So, you know, our markets, we're touching returns of 27-28% this year, which hasn't happened in a very, very long time. At the same time, world markets have done exactly the same, and we're watching the tech-heavy NASDAQ quite heavily, because that's what's going to happen this week. We've got Alphabet, we've got NVIDIA, which last week for a brief period was the largest company in the world. Can you believe it? And you've got Meta also having a terrific run. So for those South African investors who have externalized or even via their pension funds, we are all benefiting from this bull market. You know, pension funds can now take 45% of their assets abroad, and most of them have. And if you look in your portfolio, and I actually had a little session with young investors over the weekend, and I was showing them how their portfolios were exposed to the products in their hand, their cell phones, their Apples, their Samsungs. And I said, guys, you're invested in these companies, and let me show you how it works. And they were quite fascinated by this, and they went away with a totally different perspective. You know, what the product that they use on a daily basis is what they're investing in. And that's how the markets work, and that's how the world works. So, yeah, great time for markets. For South Africa, we've had, as I say, matching for the year-on-year most world markets, with the exception of the NASDAQ, which is still outperforming everything else in sight.
Well, well done to you for having that engagement with young investors. Often we kind of forget that financial literacy is not taught in schools, and so you've got to pick it up somewhere. Hopefully we are doing our bit by having programs on BizNews that people can open their eyes. But it really is a very different world to the one that might be taught by certain people in certain universities. But getting back to the Magnificent Seven, you mentioned NVIDIA versus Apple to be the one of the biggest companies or the most valuable company in the world. This week, with the five of them coming through, Alphabet tonight, then we have Meta, then we have Amazon, then we have Apple, but we don't have NVIDIA until later in November. And it doesn't mean that NVIDIA's share price is going to be unaffected, because all of these big companies, the other members of the Magnificent Seven, we had the other one, Tesla, last week, they are going to give their numbers on their investments, how much are they spending in CapEx. And if the CapEx numbers are big, then NVIDIA is going to get even stronger. It's extraordinary. How are you playing it within your clients' portfolios? because NVIDIA's had a great run, we've got another stock in our portfolio, and we actually got a webinar at lunchtime today called Palantir, which has done almost as well as NVIDIA. But now they're getting such big percentages of the portfolios that our view has been sell half and just let the rest run, because you really can't tell when this, if it is a bubble, is going to pop, or if it isn't a bubble, how long it's going to go.
You know, I've read so many reports over the last couple of years, in fact, over the last 10 years, from commentators, oh, this is a bubble, get out, this is a bubble, get out. And, you know, if you've listened to that, you know, you've just lost out on such wonderful growth opportunities. You know, at Brentis, we've been quite early in the technology space, going back 10, 12 years. And some of our investors who withstood the volatility and just let the portfolio do its work, they have made phenomenal returns. We still like technology because we can't get technology via South African portfolios. You need to go offshore to go and get it, either directly or into a fund. And in so we've got some very, very happy investors who they bought the technology story, which I was quite strong on. I said, guys, we do not have a technology sector in South Africa. We have to go offshore to get some money. And we did this many, many years ago. So we're riding that bull market. How long can it last? I'm not that smart. I'm not smarter than the market. I'm just saying I would like to have some of my money involved in that sector, whether it's a technology fund or a biotechnology fund or direct shareholdings in those companies. It's been quite a fascinating ride if you look at some of the returns.
It has indeed, and I like the fact now that in our portfolios, what we have in these two high flyers is – there for free, because we already made profits. So now don't, it just takes off the table any of this debate. I mean, imagine if you'd sold NASPAS in any time up until it actually peaked with the 10 cent investment. Magnus, coming home, we had results yesterday from Pick and Pay. You know Sean Summers very well. He's come back into the hot seat there at the age of 70. Is he doing his bit yet? Are you giving him the benefit of the doubt, or is he already showing that he is moving in the right direction?
Well, I think as I said, I know Sean, and we had a very, very fascinating dinner with him at your business conference not so long ago, and he was quite very honest. He said, "Listen, I'm cleaning house," and that's what you would expect someone like him to come out from the outside who knew the business from the ground up. So he's cleaning house. No surprises that the losses have ballooned to quite extravagant numbers. I mean, it's run about 700, 800 million rand, no dividend, closing stores. And, you know, that's what the market expected. I mean, you can see it in the share price, which is down from about 68 rand a year ago, down to 26. But there seems to be a bottom, I think, no surprises. And with a bit of luck, lower interest rates, Pick and Pay coming back at the market and taking their competitors head on, mainly ShopRite, Checkers, to a lesser extent, Woolworths. I mean, do not underestimate Sean Summers. He's a very, very smart operator, very smart man. He knows the business, and he was very honest. He says, "I know what to do. It's going to take time. We need to raise cash. We need to list the Boxer." But, you know, I'm not scared of these guys. You know, remember, we forget that 10, 15 years ago, Checkers and ShopRite was a disaster story. I mean, Checkers was down market, bad products. Housewives were not happy. And they turned it around fairly dramatically. And it'll be very nice to a year or two from now to say, Sean has done it. He's turned around Pick and Pay, which, I mean, you and I grew up with Pick and Pay, I mean, almost on a daily basis. So no surprises. Losses have ballooned. But I think we're very close to the bottom. And I think the next reporting periods, you'll start seeing the improvement coming through to the bottom line.
It is an old trick, and I'm not accusing Sean of doing this, but when you are a new chief executive, clean the decks, wipe out all the bad stuff, get rid of all the rubbish, and then you have a decent base from which to work. What about Baldwin Properties? There's a company that seems to be in a little bit of trouble. Their profits have halved. Their revenues are down sharply. It is a field you know well, properties and property development. Their results for the 6 months to end August were out yesterday. They're saying temporary blip. Do you agree?
You know, the property market, especially the residential property market, has been an economic wasteland for a number of years. First of all, the very high interest rates in South Africa has really just squeezed the property market. And I looked the other day, I think we have the fourth highest real interest rates in the world at the moment. And we've had that for a very long time. Property market cannot flourish with expensive money. It needs cheap money, first of all. Secondly, it needs consumers who have a good credit rating. And that's not mentioned in the reports, but you can pick it up in other reports. You've got about 60% of people who apply for mortgage bonds who are turned down that because they have bad credit records. They've mismanaged their accounts. So they cannot get bonds in terms of the national credit regulator. So that's the kind of unspoken reality of the residential property market. And the Baldwin model is build them fast, sell them fast in great numbers. And a very, very successful company over many, many years. But that model only works when there is abundant money with people wanting to buy property. In the last 2 to 3 years, that has changed. So they're building and now they've changed their business model to a certain extent. They're now buying to rent. They will build and rent it out and manage it, which is not a bad strategy because they're fixing their costs now. They're managing it out. And then when the upturn comes, they will release that back to the market. But the numbers reflect a very depressed property market, especially in the northern parts of the country. You know, Tshwane, Gauteng, which is their big areas, and around the area that I live, Daneferne. So, you know, they're building very nice developments, but the profits are not what they used to be. So there's margin squeeze, there's sales have declined. So, you know, great company. They've done very well over many, many years, but it is a very, very tough environment to survive, even, you know, not even making profits.
Magnus Hastick is the founder and chief investment officer of Brenthurst, and bringing us up to date there on a number of issues. We will be talking to Magnus pretty regularly on this program in future. Somebody that we love talking to is Gayton McKenzie. Chris Stain, my colleague, had a fabulous interview with Gayton yesterday, and she started off by saying to the country's third most popular politician, that came out from the Institute for Race Relations research this week, what he thought of being called, on the other hand, Cyril Ramaphosa's water boy, an apple carrier.
I saw the comment of the water boy, an apple bearer. First, I don't even like apples, but yeah, I would like carry apples for someone. But when Neil de Beer said that, my advice to him, I'm not going to resort to name calling, but my advice to him would be that he should try to build his party and concentrate on his party, and maybe one day he can do those things that we are not doing in parliament, in cabinet, in ministry, in provincial government, places he's not been to. So I think he must use his energy rather to concentrate on getting his party to the level where he can do all the things he always criticized us for.
Gayton, how is it going in the government of national unity? How strong is it holding together?
Well, I think we started like a rocket, started very well. I think we are facing our first headwinds as the government of national unity. I think that between the ANC and the DA, see people making mistakes. Like, for instance, the ANC would, for instance, use terms like erstwhile oppressors when referring to the DA, which I think is insulting, is wrong. It needs to be called. They need to be called to order. The DA then also, I see they're making a critical mistake in wanting to not accept that we serve at the behest of the president. We serve as the GNU. We found certain laws there, and those laws will stand until it gets repealed. There's still some apartheid laws in government. You can't just, you know, literally remove laws. You gotta repeal them first. There's a process you have to go through. So the foreign policy, for instance, which is the hot potatoes at the moment, the foreign policy of the ANC became the foreign policy of the government. And until we repel it, it's still standing. Now you can't think of the foreign policy to your head today and tomorrow you've got a different one. I don't agree with most of the foreign policy of South Africa. I don't agree with, but I have to respect it because that's the current one. Until we change it. That's why we've created this cabinet. There's the cabinet committees. There's the clearinghouse, which is specifically our brainchild to sort out problems like this ones. Now, when leaders create the clearinghouse and then they go to the public, to play to the public gallery, it's wrong. It's wrong. It's fine now to play to the public gallery and call others water bottles for knowing who we serve under number one. You know, it's fine for that, but you know what? The enemies of the GNU, they are organizing themselves. They look at cracks. We should never show cracks as the GNU. We should sit behind closed doors. Look at the Bella Bill is the best example for me. We were against the Bella Bill. I got a call from John Steenhuisen, and he asked me, what's your take on the Bella Bill? And I told him I'm against certain aspects, 4 and 5. He then said he's also against it. Freedom Sandplas was against it. We then decided, let us verbalize our disagreement. And the president, you know what it took of the ANC to listen to us and to come back to us and say, those points that you're unhappy about, we are going to withdraw them. There were a lot of people in the ANC that said, Cyril Ramaphosa is being controlled. While he took a leadership position in furthering the GNU. No ego. He was criticized, but he said, I'm going to take that decision. And the ANC took that decision, which I think they should be praised for.
We'll hear more from Gayton McKenzie later in the program. Also more on the Bella Bill. But right now, my colleague Chris Steyn and advocate Pietra van Niekerk have been digging deeply into an organization in South Africa called Bankso. There is a regulation that has stopped Bankso from working. The authorities have moved in. And what brought it to the attention of Chris and Pietra were deep fake ads. Now, Pietra is an advocate. She got caught by the deep fake ads. What they were videos of Johann Rupert, Elon Musk, Nikki Oppenheimer telling you that you must invest here because this is a great investment. And when people follow that supposed advice, they end up losing a lot of money. Indeed, this morning I had an email from somebody who says they've lost 180,000 rand through Bankso. I'm sure we will find that there will be further investigation into it. Bankso's side is that it's not them. They're not the people involved. It isn't their problem. There are people abusing their system. Well, an anonymous investor who I know and is a very senior person, leave it at that, in the financial services industry, joins us now to talk us through investigations that he's been doing. Hi, Anonymous. I perhaps you could just explain why you want to stay anonymous.
Good morning, Alec. Nice to chat to you. I think, you know, the reason for the anonymity is, you know, I do work for a respected financial services company. I've been following your investigation and found it fascinating. And, you know, I know it's being investigated at the moment, so I just feel, you know, while the investigations are still ongoing, I'd rather stay anonymous and not like to slate other operators in the business, not that I'd compare ourselves to them.
Brilliant. And your interest was sparked by an advert that you saw by cricket legend Hashim Amla. Just take us through the story and what you did.
Sure. So I was scrolling through Facebook, as I sometimes do, and I kept on seeing a pop-up ad, and it was titled something along the lines of Hashim Amla never realized he was off air. And after seeing it 2 or 3 times, I thought, let me actually just see what that was about. And I clicked on it. And essentially, it was a skit with Hashim Amla as a commentator with a game of cricket in the background, talking to other commentators, clearly a break in the cricket. And where he talks to the other presenters about how much money he had made investing on some crypto platform. So I thought, well, that's quite interesting. And, you know, reading your investigation, I clicked on, I think it was Find Out More. And, you know, immediately a page popped up, asked for my name, my cell phone number, and an email address. I popped that in, and within, it must have been 15, 20 minutes, I got a call from somebody from AfriMarket. You know, same sort of lines as what you've uncovered in your investigation. And so that's where it started.
Take us through what happened then.
So from there, you know, I got this call from an onboarder who explained how the process worked. And essentially, I had to deposit a minimum of 4,500 Rand. And I would then be given a expert. And the terminology they used was somebody with extensive financial markets experience and an expert in financial markets who would assist me with making money on their platform. What was quite bizarre, I then asked if I could choose my own expert. I just said, you know, what I'd like to do is screen through a few people and maybe select somebody that I felt I could work with, see what qualifications and what experience they had. And that wasn't taken too well, to be honest. I was questioned quite hard why that's the case. I just said, you know, if I invest my money in something like an Alan Gray, for argument's sake, I can look at, I can see who the fund manager is, I can see their track record, I can see what they're holding, and I can find out a little bit more about the actual fund manager or the team who's managing my money. And I suggested that that should be a reasonable request. We then got to a loggerhead, and I was explained that that's not the way it works. If, in fact, I was unhappy at a later stage, I could always ask for a new expert to assist me. It then, at the end of it, I left it at that. Funny enough, last night I had a call from somebody else who said, you know, I believe you raised some questions and can I assist? And again, I said, this is my position. I'd like to know who's going to be helping me. I told them that I was a pensioner. I didn't have a lot of money to lose. So I really needed to make sure that my money was going to be looked after by somebody who knew a lot more than me. So that's where I've been in my investigation. I see this morning I've actually had an email from them, you know, suggesting, let me just open it up here, suggesting I should join a AfriMarket's Telegram channel for market insights and webinars. So, you know, clearly it's a very hard sell, Alec.
And who is AfriMarkets? Who are the people behind it?
Well, I did ask that question. I raised the fact that their website looked very similar to the Banxo website. In fact, a lot of it was exactly the same. And the lady who spoke to me, I don't know if I can mention names, but she, as far as she knew, she said it's a completely different company, but they're the same shareholders. I then asked if she knew who the chief operating officer was. And, you know, she put me on hold, came back, and then told me that it was the same chief operating officer from Banxo. So, you know, from my perspective, it just seems like a rebrand and copy of Banxo. And, you know, in further investigation, which scared the living hell out of me, was AfriMarkets actually has a FSP number. I actually had a look on the website, and they registered with FSCA.
Okay, let's just understand this. They are, well, before we go there, from everything that you've seen, does this look like a scam to you of a similar sort that has been alleged with Banxa?
Oh, completely. You know, what they were going to do with money if I deposited, I have no idea. But, you know, it was an extremely hard, aggressive sell with, you know, no discussion at any stage about my financial wellness. There was a question, I was asked, what's your knowledge? You know, there's a question and answer page at some point later on. And they do ask what your knowledge is. They ask what your income is and what your expenses are. But there's nothing about risk profiling at all. I just found, you know, it's a very anonymous, very hard sell push that, you know, I felt extremely uncomfortable with. You know, I think I probably know a little bit more about investments than most people, but, you know, it's convincing, but at the same token, if you're aware of what's going out there and keep your ears and eyes open, it's quite frightening. Just how many people can get taken in by things like this, Alec.
So I guess the big question here is this a clone of Banxa done by the Banxa people now that they're not allowed to trade anymore? Or is this somebody copycatting Banxa? You say that the chief operating officer is the same person. Who did the lady working at AfriMarket tell you the chief operating officer was?
Emmanuel de Kraki. It was Emmanuel de Oranda, I think it was.
De Andrada.
Hang on, let's just. Yes, that's right.
The same guy who was the chief operating officer at Banxa.
Correct. I actually asked him, I said, didn't he work at Banxa? And the lady said, she's not sure. So I said, I'm pretty sure he worked at Banxa. Said, well, he's our chief operating officer. So, you know, I mean, that makes me think it's a copy and paste. It certainly, it looks and feel like a copy and paste. The modus operandi, the details they give you, you know, the name, the telephone number, the minimum amounts that you have to invest, all look exactly the same.
Anonymous investor who's done research into a story that we've been following for quite some time now. And, well, I'm pretty sure that the people at the Financial Services Authority are going to be very interested in listening to that if they aren't already with us. Well, we're going to be talking Vilgenhoff in just a moment. But before we get there, I promised you another clip from Gaetan McKenzie. This is a pretty serious one where he says that the Government of National Unity is ignoring the biggest threat to the country. Let's have a listen to this clip from his interview with Chris Dane, my colleague. By the way, it's on BizNews TV and BizNews Radio. You can listen to the whole thing at your leisure.
Now, Gaetan, many of the predictions you made pre the election have come true. So I think you are a good person to ask, what are your predictions for the 2026 municipal elections?
Yes, I think we are in trouble. And I say we, I think we are in serious trouble. I remember when I was on the Daily Maverick platform with John Steenhuisen, Sabisa, Mashaba. The question was asked by Stephen Grotius, what do you think about MK and Zuma's chances? All of them on that stage said, he's not a threat. Is not a threat. I then said to Stephen Grotius, the tapes are there. I said, they are all lying. They are not living in reality. Zuma's going to be a force to be reckoned with. Zuma's going to come in like a tornado. Well, the rest is history. Zuma has shown us. Now, if you think Zuma has come through like a tornado, he's going to come through in 2026 like a tsunami. Zuma is working day and night. Now, people that hate Zuma don't want to hear this, but, you know, we must be realistic about it. You know, Zuma is bringing in, whether you call them state capture guys, whether you call them criminals, he's bringing people in with a following. And that's what politics is about. It's about the following. And Zuma's pulling everyone in. He had a coup. I mean, to bring in Floyd Chivambo, that brains. We all know Zuma is, we can see how he's always with Floyd. Zuma is grooming Floyd. So people that say Zuma's old, he knows he's old. But while the ANC is still busy with 2027, instead of Quantrill 2026, the ANC is busy lobbying who must take positions. If they are not careful, Zuma is going to become the biggest party. And the GNU is the only thing that can stop Zuma, not the ANC, the GNU. If the GNU produces, if the GNU does well, if the GNU keeps to their promises and they change South Africa for the better, people will then say, but why do you change? You don't change a winning model. But if the GNU bickers and the GNU wants to play to the gallery and the GNU partners are fighting for each other, that's a gift to Zuma. Whether you like Zuma or whatever, Zuma got right what the ANC and all of us failed to get right. He managed to basically half destroy the EFF. The ANC couldn't. The Zuma, that thing is finished called EFF. I mean, like, it's finished. Let me tell you, they can talk. There's no ideology left. It's just insults that's left there. The people, the thinkers that's left, the thinkers that remain, I'm told confidentially, they're also on their way out. So I'm saying to you that the DA and the ANC should stop, put party first. And should put country first.
I just love Gayton with his filter-free approach. He's telling us confidentially that the EFF is over. But we did have Makoni Maja yesterday telling us that with the most interesting things of the by-elections last week, and there were six of them, was that there were no EFF candidates. Now, in every single by-election, even if they only got five votes, they put up candidates into wards for the first time ever. That's not happening. Well, a big story that has been rocking South Africa for some months now is the residence, the men's residence at Stellenbosch University called Vulkenhof. Jaco Rabie joins us now. He has been instrumental, and we've spoken with him a number of times on BizNews. And we also have Willy Okamp, who is from the Democratic Alliance and a member of parliament and the spokesman for the Democratic Alliance. But let's kick off with Jaco. It was a bombshell over the weekend in Report newspaper, which got hold of the affidavit from the Chancellor of Stellenbosch University, Edwin Cameron, highly respected former judge in the Constitutional Court, who says that the Vice-Chancellor, in other words, like the CEO of Stellenbosch University, and the chair of the council have altered that report. Jaco, this, you suggest, changes everything. Tell us why.
Well, I think the facts contained in the report really speak for themselves. The simple fact of the matter is that there was an so-called independent panel appointed to assist the university in leading them on the facts and to an appropriate decision. And basis what's contained in Justice Cameron's report, it's clear that an alternative to closure was initially part of the panel's recommendation. In fact, it was an alternative which the panel said, quote, appealed to them. Then, as a result of an interaction between the Vice Chancellor, the Rector, and the panel, that alternative was removed from the report. And the removal of that alternative to closure obviously changed the entire tenor and complexion of the recommendation. And in addition, these changes were not brought to the attention of counsel, the ultimate decision maker. They were faced with a report which had only one recommendation, a closure, and were apparently completely unaware that up until a couple of days earlier, there had in fact been an alternative to closure contained in the report.
This is a hectic allegation, because it would suggest that those who got the independent panel to remove the alternative were trying to mislead the university council. I suppose it's in the affidavit. It's pretty clear. What are you guys calling for now?
Well, we've been, as you may know, there was recently a settlement between the Residents Association, as distinct from us, from the Alumni Association and the university, as it relates to their litigation around the closure of the residence. The residents had approached the High Court for an urgent interdictory relief to stop the implementation of the decision to close the residence. That matter has now been settled. The Alumni Association were never part of that settlement, and our legal action continues. And it's in support of that case that this affidavit was filed. The Alumni Association are seeking to review and set aside the report of the panel, the recommendations flowing from it, and ultimately the decision to close the residence. And of course, this affidavit raises questions around the integrity of the process. It raises questions around the independence of the panel. It raises questions of bias. And as Justice Cameron says in the affidavit, it may be appropriate that a court ultimately adjudicate on what happened here. And that's our position going forward.
What surprises me is that the panel they took a lot of time. They appear to be people with integrity. They put this report together, and from what the judge says, Judge Cameron says, was that they knew that their report that had been given to the council was different to the one that they put together. That's the nub of this matter. And yet none of them spoke out. Are you suggesting that they were on the conspiracy with the vice chancellor and the head of the council? And I mean, you may as well just mention that it's Professor Wim de Villiers and former CEO of the Stock Exchange, Nicky Newton King, who's the head of the council. Are you saying that there's some kind of a conspiracy that was going on here to close the residence?
I don't want to draw any implications like that. The fact is we don't know what the motives were of the people involved. All we know is what happened. And what happened is that there was an interaction between Wim de Villiers and the panel. And as a result of that interaction, within almost 24 hours, the panel had materially altered what was in that report from an alternative of dialogue, mediation, amelioration, to taking this alternative and lumping it in together with options that were ultimately, according to the panel, not workable, leaving only closure on the table. Those are the facts. Why it happened and the implications of what happened, that would be speculation. I don't think it's necessary to speculate. The facts speak for themselves.
Are there parallels here with what happened at Pretoria Girls High? And I ask this because Richard Wilkinson, who's been writing in great depth about Pretoria Girls High, in fact, he's got another piece on it. The headmistress there is still suspended. He reckons there are parallels. In other words, there was a particular agenda that was being followed. What is your position on that?
Again, I'm not really comfortable speculating on whether there are agendas being implemented. What is clear to us is that there was an intervention here which was negative for the residents and for the alumni, that the university had input into the panel and their report, which clearly nobody else had. And as a result of that input, a material change was made, and the decision maker was, in our view, not apprised of all of the facts when making the decision. The decision maker being being counsel. Again, the motives and the agendas, well, that's for other people to speculate about. We're simply interested in the narrow facts, and that it's appropriate that these facts be placed before a court to ultimately decide on the legal import of what happened.
Jaco Rabie is the spokesman for the Vilgenhof Alumni Association. Willie Oukamp is a member of parliament, and it wasn't long after the report story came out with reference to former constitutional judge Edwin Cameron's affidavit that you made some, again, pretty hectic calls, Willie. You want the suspension of both Nicky Newton-King and Wim de Villiers. This is quite reputationally damaging to both of them, and clearly you would have thought this through very carefully before making that call. Explain your thinking.
Good morning, Alec. Alec, we must go back into the history of what happened with regards to Wim de Villiers and the University of Stellenbosch. You just used the word reputational damage to them, but I think we must look at this out of the perspective of the university. What is the reputational damage towards this university that Professor Wim de Villiers has forced upon that university? In 2022, there was allegations of nepotism against him. He admitted that he allowed his wife's cousin or nephew to study medical studies through the university whilst he did not comply to all the requirements thereof. And whilst there were other people that were on top of him on the list, so he benefited a family member, and that was apparently not the first time. So that in itself is huge reputational damage when the rector of a university comes and benefits in contrast to what the university's transformation policy says. He benefited one of his own family members. Then we had the whole thing with regards to his handling of Afrikaans as a language, mother tongue education, etc., on that campus, which again, if you look at the outcry that was there, had huge reputational damage to the university itself. And now, Alec, we've got a former constitutional court judge, the highest court in the country, that is currently the chancellor of that university. And he comes out and he say, I saw the initial report that was done by the independent panel that was appointed by you, Professor Wim de Villiers. I saw that report. You sent it to me. Then afterwards, you sent me a new report, redacted, which in essence, although it's a few very small changes, but in essence changed the whole of the recommendations of that report. Then Judge de Villiers, Judge Cameron made him aware of the fact that there are substantial changes that was made through that. Prof. Wim de Villiers disagrees. At the end, he wrote a letter to Prof. de Villiers and said, at the very least, let the panel, let the board of the university know that you have suggested some changes. And even after that, Prof. de Villiers still refused. He didn't want to only not show them what the initial report was. He didn't want to let them know what the fact that he made or suggested some changes. And I think that, Alec, is very important. Here you sit with the chancellor of your university trying to give you advice. He is a former justice of the Constitutional Court. His advice should be sound. That is one of the reasons why he is there. And you basically just refuse to take his advice. If you look at what's going on here, Alec, this is extremely worrying, especially if you talk about the reputational damage of the university. I do not so much care for the reputational damage of Professor Wim de Villiers and Mrs. Nicky Newton-King. They are the architects of their own sorrows in the way that they've handled this.
I guess from the business community's perspective, Nikki Newton-King's well known. She was the CEO of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange from 2012 to 2019. She resigned or left there at the age of 53, which was a surprise because she was still quite young. But how was she dragged into all of this, or was she a willing participant?
She definitely was a willing participant. If you look at the statement of Justice Cameron, he makes it very clear that he had discussions with her as well, that she was full on board. And in one of the paragraphs in Justice Cameron's statement, affidavit, he says that there seems to be a contradictory between what Prof. de Villiers told him on the phone, of which he gave a transcription on a voice note, and of that Mrs. Newton-King says. So the fact of the matter is you've got two individuals here who are on the top structure of management at the university. Both of those two people knew, firstly, that the initial report was changed, and it seems that both of them refused to let the board know of those changes. And that is unacceptable. The best thing here, Alec, would have been for Prof. de Villiers to resign. There has already been a new rector appointed for that university, and that appointment will come into effect in next year. So it is not as if the university will now be leaderless. He can step into that role immediately. We would expect, Alec, that the leader or the rector of a university like Stellenbosch will be a person that has got character and integrity. And my problem with Prof. de Villiers is if you look at the background of all the many things that happened in the past that he got away with, that it seems to me that his integrity compass needs some calibration. It is definitely not calibrated as it should be. And I therefore do not have a lot of hope and faith that he will do the honorable thing by resigning. The board is meeting in this week still. We will see what happens there. But what the Democratic Alliance has asked for is that there must definitely be an independent panel that be appointed by the deputy chairperson of council that will now investigate this. And if it then seems that the allegations made by Justice Cameron is true, then I can't see any way out other than Prof. de Villiers and Mrs. Nikki Newton-King resigning from their positions.
Willie Okump is a member of parliament. He's with the Democratic Alliance. And, well, that's all about the Vilgenhoff affair. We're going to stay with a little bit of politics now with Ian Cameron. Before we go there, though, let's just have a quick listen to Christopher Cordero. He is an agitator for the Bella Bill being passed over. We do know from Gayton McKenzie that he's also against the Bella Bill, as is the DA, as is the Freedom Front Plus. But there's a pretty strong argument that Mr. Cordero makes. He spoke yesterday with Chris Stain.
I think it's important to understand that this bill has actually been rejected by the public in large, large numbers, not just on the policy, on the language policy and admission to schools that actually gets all of the media attention. You know, it was homeschoolers who rejected the bill in the largest numbers. The largest number of no's were from homeschoolers. The public rejected the bill concerning the alcohol clause, which has come out of the bill, but there is actually a procedural flaw. There are three clauses which are sort of not really known or recognized a lot, and one is closure of small schools, and this is blatantly the most substantive flaw in the bill, which is that small schools can be closed. That's it. To keep it simple, primary schools, let's say under 135 learners, could be closed without reasons being given. And that's completely against the PADGA, against the administrative justice principles in the Constitution. And that is a huge constitutional flaw. And so that's a concern for people in rural areas. So the concerns of the bill are not in the stereotypical way in which it's being presented. There's a huge concern from people of faith, traditional leaders, about the potential for the Clause 39, which actually allows for the minister to make regulations on the management of learner pregnancy, that they would then put the very controversial management of learner pregnancy policy into a kind of into regulations. And that policy is quite explicit, that there are schools to facilitate abortion for learners as young as 12 without reference or consent from parents.
Now, that's another hectic statement there right at the end. Ian Cameron joins us. Ian, according to the Bella Bill, from what Christopher Cordero says, the school can actually allow abortions for children who are as young as 12 years old without referring anything to the parents. Yo, that seems like something slipped through there.
Yeah, it's shocking. It's absolutely shocking. It's, I don't even know what to say about it. It's they'll actually force people not to abide by the law. That's what they, in essence, are going to do.
Well, let's hope that we will get more response from the other side of the Bella Bullet. The ANC has been notable by its absence in commenting on some of those controversial terms, but it does appear as though common sense will come through eventually. It certainly has in your case, Ian. You've been banging the drum about an audit of the top level of the South African police services. I remember some of our conversations when you said there are hundreds, literally hundreds of generals who've been deployed by the ANC, cadres deployed into the police services. They don't know much about policing, and this is being reflected in the high crime rate and others in South Africa. How exactly did this skills audit get through Parliament, given that there is there are a lot of deployed cadres who are going to be pretty upset about this?
No, it was actually not difficult. It was a suggestion that was made in the Police Portfolio Committee after the budget review process, or during those reports that were being done. And it actually stemmed out of a suggestion that came from the Auditor General and from the South African Police Service. And the South African Police Service management launched a process to do skills audits and a bit of a upskilling process for station commanders, and to make sure that record keeping and reporting is improved. And it was actually a flaw that was found by the Auditor General, that there's a big problem or a gap in terms of feedback and communication from station level. And we then said, but wait a minute, the stations aren't the critical problems. Every time we go to the stations, it's clear to us that the major crisis is at the top. So if you're not led properly, there's no use in doing courses at the bottom, but the top structure is not adequate. And that's when the suggestion came in with the portfolio committee, and it was phenomenal. I mean, there was no party whatsoever that objected to that specific point, and the report was adopted through the committee, so I assume it will be adopted in Parliament over the next 2 weeks.
What does it mean?
Well, it basically means, and the suggestion is that we look at that we can start with the top 50 in the South African Police Service. We've got quite far over 200 generals at the moment, which in my opinion is way, way, way too bloated, especially in a police service that cannot afford that amount of generals. But we've got we have to start there and determine who is there due to merit and who is there due to political affiliation or other reasons. And if it is any of the latter two, then they need to go. And we need to make sure that we restructure SAPS accordingly. And I think it is a very uncomfortable discussion. I know it's a very uncomfortable discussion. It's something that we've mentioned time and again in the portfolio committee as well. And it keeps on being followed by a very awkward silence. But be that as it may, I believe it's something so important to go for. And also, Alec, you know, there's no use in sticking a plaster on a wound that needs surgery. And if we're doing courses on ground level, I keep on hearing answers from certain senior managers in SAPS that tell me that, you know, it's due to a resource shortage. And then I say, ladies and gentlemen, it's not because of a resource shortage. Yes, that is an issue, but that's not the main problem with SAPS. The main problem in South African Police Service is a leadership issue. And from that stems issues regarding integrity and regarding corruption and so on and so forth. And if we solve that, then the rest will start to fall in place.
Now, you have allegations that you defamed the Overstrand general because you said she was not qualified. Where's that court action gone?
No, nowhere. I mean, she opened a criminal injuria case against me because I blew the whistle on her appointment. And never heard anything again. It's something, she is also on the list for appointments that need to be followed up. We've started with other promotions and appointments by referring some of them to the Public Service Commission for investigation there to determine whether they are adequate for the position or not. And Major General Mushilogi is certainly one of the next ones. The big thing is, I mean, let me just remind everyone, I mean, she entered the police about 14 years ago, 13 years ago, and she's already a Major General, zero police experience. She came in an administrative position, and now she's in an operational position, not even from the Western Cape, and she has to run probably what is known as the abalone capital of South Africa. She certainly doesn't have the skills or the background to do that. There's no way that she even understands organized crime on the level that she needs to combat this. She can open all the criminal jury cases she likes. The fact of the matter is we need people that are fit for purpose.
Are there many like her in the police service?
Unfortunately, there are quite a few, but what's encouraging to me that there are a lot of people that have hung on and that really keep on working so hard despite difficult circumstances, and that's really encouraging to me. Unfortunately, we do have more of those types of appointments, but it's interesting, Alec, over the last few months, and I don't know if it's because it must be because of the GNU dynamic, it seems like a lot of the rotten apples are being exposed quite quickly. You would have noted on Sunday, there was an article on the front page of Sunday Times regarding two generals having a go at each other. I'm going to leave my opinion on the side for now, but there are question marks regarding both, especially the one pretending to be the innocent one. A lot of question marks about previous doings with that person. And that makes it, it's starting to show me that the uncomfortable questions, the pressure from the police minister seems to be resulting in discomfort. And that's very good. We need them to be uncomfortable. We need them to start moving. And hopefully we can start squeezing them out of the police.
Do the skills exist to run the police properly within either the police service or outside? And I mean that from a South African point of view, or are we going to have to start importing a whole lot of top policemen?
No, they definitely do exist. I think we've got all the existing skills in South Africa. We have got such a wealth of knowledge. It's always fantastic for me to speak to, whether it's in the private sector or in the police, and just see how incredibly knowledgeable we are to combat certain things. So again, it comes back to the leadership issue, because we can stop almost anything we want to. We can curb organized crime. If we take hands with the private sector in a sensible way, there's so much more that we could do to fast track our progress in developing a more advanced police service. And we can do all of those things. I think also what's important, Alec, and I've noted criticism, and some of the criticism might be good for a note in terms of police acting more harshly, the shootings that have been happening over the last few months. But I must also say with that, you know, if you go and compare the amount of shoots and the proactive operations being done by the police compared to just arrests, it's a minimal amount of people that are being fatally wounded. And then also, you know, everyone complains the police are doing nothing. Now when they go and take on serious organized crime syndicates and they get shot at, you cannot expect them to ask the robber to have coffee with them. I think the critical part is to make sure that you've got all the checks and balances in place to make sure that nothing or no one is executed. And I say it bluntly because that's the perception that is created by certain parts in the media. And I think it's important, though, that we also support the police that make this very brave and, you know, courageous step forward to say, but we are going to fight back. And the boost in morale in certain parts of the police so far, it's, again, so encouraging. And it's something that I believe that we can build on. And obviously, again, checks and balances must be in place. But we need to cherish the good cops that we have. And luckily, we still have quite a few.
And we need to cherish the good politicians that we have, like Ian Cameron. Well, it's been a pleasure being with you today here for the BizNews Briefing. I know I went a little over the usual hour of power that we give you, but why not? It's live streaming. It's we've got no other clocks that we have to follow. I hope you enjoyed our company today, and we look forward to being back in your company tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. from technical producer Ruan Erasmus, our executive producer Lucy Ferreira, and yours truly, Alec Hogg. Until then, cheerio.